My name is Ben. I'm glad to be preaching for you today as we dig a little bit deeper into the divinity of Jesus. I've been, for the last couple weeks, really thinking about remembering how important it is to remember the things that we've lived through, the things that try to shape us, the things that try to define us, things about our past. And in this, as we try to remember. I think what struck me is how important that is, how hard that is, but how important it is. And I was thinking this through as I was writing this sermon, and I had this metaphor in my head of remembering as this chisel in your hand, and the present is like the mallet, and when you put the present with the remembering, when you hit them together, you're able to carve something. You're able to create. You're able to shape the future. You're able to shape meaning. You're able to shape your self-identity with the remembering and with which would be the chisel, and with the mallet, which would be the day. All we have is today, and all we have is the ability to remember. We can't change the past. We can't define the future. But what we can do is take today and do the most with it as that we can. And memory as a chisel is a sharp instrument. And to really hone it takes skill and it takes patience. And with memory as our chisel and the present as our mouth, we get to shape our self-understanding. But when we leave that chisel untouched, when we forget to use that, when we think that we don't need to go back, when we think that we don't need to address the things in the past. It's like trying to carve with a mallet and no chisel. It's all you have is a blunt instrument that can never do any good. I want to tell you the story of a woman who, when I heard her story, really struck me with this concept. She remembers her early 40s, not long ago, because she remembers the struggle of fighting every single minute to stay sober. She had been a chronic alcoholic for so long that she couldn't remember a time when the craving didn't captivate her. She remembers the way the chisel of remembering felt in her hand and the weight of the mallet. And she remembers fearing the keen edge of the blade on herself as she put it to its work for the first time. And because of her past, her chisel has more work to do than most. Her mom had had a psychotic breakdown when Mary was just 7. And Mary remembers coming out into the yard and seeing everything that she owned, all of her clothes and all of her toys, in a pile. And she remembers the first wisps of smoke coming up over that pile. And the moment that she realized that her mother had just set all of her belongings on fire in the yard. Needless to say, Mary lived a virtually and practically motherless childhood. She was raised mostly by her alcoholic father. With all that she lived through, remembering this task of taking little pieces at a time, little scraps, little fragments, and piecing them together and trying to make sense. She remembers Dad saying, "Church is something for poor people. It's this trick that they play on them so that they can take advantage of them. It's for fools." And she was not only a chronic alcoholic, but she's also a chronic agnostic. She said, "If you told me just a few years ago that I'd wind up whispering my sins at a confessional or on my knees praying, I would have laughed myself cockeyed. I'm more likely pastime, the way I'm more likely to spend my time, pole dancer, international spy, drug mule, assassin, anything but spending my time at church." Now this Mary that I speak of, she's a real person. Her name is Mary Carr. She's a best-selling author. Maybe you've read The Liars Club, which tells the story of her childhood. And I give this glimpse of her story because as we dive into the divinity of Jesus, I think it talks about this this thing that we have to deal with if we're going to talk about that. And this thing is doubt. It's this chronic doubt, this chronic agnosticism, this radical doubt that really defines who we are. It's something that's part of our national identity. It defines who we are as individuals, and it defines who we are as a people. It's one of the tenets of modernism. And I think if we try to talk about the divinity of Jesus without talking about this radical doubt, we will do ourselves a disservice. This story is a story of living in chronic fear. It's about living in an obstinate doubt, the story that she lives. And it's the same story that we see Jesus stepping into. It defies all of us, and it seeks to define all of us. And we have to address it. In this journey, as we go through Lent, we've talked about Jesus from a lot of different angles. We talked about Jesus in his humanity. In this sermon series, we talked about Jesus and our tendency to mold Jesus in our image. And remember, a few weeks ago, we had Perry and the band. I got to play guitar. We were playing Personal Jesus by Depeche Mode. And I was talking with them about that in the chapel this morning, and they didn't get that at all, because we didn't do that in the chapel, obviously. And we've talked about all the different conspiracy theories. Remember, a couple weeks ago, Andy talked about things like the Da Vinci Code and the Jesus Seminar. And this kind of along the lines of something we're going to talk about tonight. And we talked about how Jesus, more than anything, is a friend of sinners. If we don't understand that Jesus hung around with the people that nobody else would, we don't really understand who Jesus is. And if I was a betting man, if we take all these different aspects of Jesus and we line them up and then we think about which one of the things that we have the most trouble with today, I'd say it is the divinity of Jesus. This is the thing that we struggle with the most. The divinity of Jesus grates against who we are. It demands something of us that we will not give. It offends our modern sensibilities. It makes no sense to us. And if we're being honest, I think we don't really want to talk about it. It's a different way that we need to put our chisels on our mallets to work. We need to think collectively about our stories and the way that the past has defined us. So in 1637, there's this man named Descartes. So Descartes is this guy right here with this disappointingly unimpressive facial hair. But he's got a really weak beard game, but he's one of the most influential philosophers of all time. And he said this, and this is the thing that really sticks out. He said, "Cogito ergo sum." And I can see that none of you speak Latin, but what that means is, "I think, therefore I am." And so that obviously is ringing a bell. Everybody's heard, "I think, therefore I am." But what does that really mean? "I think, therefore I am." Descartes was at this place in his life where he's trying to figure out, how do I know what's absolutely true? How do I get to the root of absolute truth? And so he's digging, and he realizes that there's bias in him. There's ways that the way that he sees the world and what he believes colors the way he interprets the world. So what he has to do is approach everything from a place of doubt. And so he starts by doubting everything. And I mean everything. And if there's anything that he can create any doubt around at all, he'll dismiss that thing. And he realizes that you can't trust your senses. They're untrustworthy. And he realizes that you can't trust yourself to understand the difference between reality and dream. And so he systematically removes everything that he could possibly doubt from the way that he understood the world to seek absolute truth. And he comes down to one thing that he can understand. Absolutely. The one thing that can't be disproven is that he exists. He says, "I think, therefore I am." He says, "I'm here to ponder my existence and doubt my existence, and therefore I must exist, otherwise I wouldn't be able to doubt my existence." Anybody confused? Is there anybody who was really, really praying this morning that God would send you somebody to give you a philosophy lecture? God, I'm in this place in my life where I'm really struggling and I need somebody to talk to me about philosophy. Nobody wants that, but I think that it's really important. So first let me apologize, but then let me say this is really important because this has shaped the way that our world works today. And it's shaped the way that our world works today because this radical doubt is the basis of all modern thinking. So this radical doubt is the basis of science. This radical doubt kind of separates thinking people from foolish people. This radical doubt means that unless you're willing to go to this place where you doubt everything that you can't prove scientifically, you shouldn't be trusted and you shouldn't be taken seriously. If you're going to be an intellectual person, you have to consent to this radical doubt. The point of this is that doubt takes hold. And most certainly, this universal radical doubt has shaped the way that we look at Scripture and the way that we think about God. And that's why we struggle so much with the divinity of Christ. Thomas Jefferson is a great example of this. Thomas Jefferson, he took the Bible, and what he decided was that he really loved the morality of Jesus. He was captivated by Jesus as a person, as a moral teacher. But because he was coming at it from this radical doubt sort of perspective, he had absolutely no use for any miracles. He had absolutely no use for a Messiah that was born of a virgin or that rose from the dead. He had absolutely no use for any of these things, and he thought them foolish. So what he did, and you can see in this slide, he literally took the Bible and cut out the parts that he didn't like. Literally, and so he just pasted together sayings of morality, and there's no miracles in the Jefferson Bible, and it's this really great example of the way that we read it, even though we don't physically do it. What is it about the Bible that you don't like? What is it about Jesus that you don't like? What is it about God that when you're confronted with it, it shakes you, and it challenges you to be different. And how are you going to respond to that? This is a really important question. Because our tendency, and what I see people doing all the time, is saying, well, I could never believe in a God that, or since God is this, God would never. But really, is that God? Is that your idea of God? Or is that God as God is? If you're thinking of God as God presents himself, he challenges you to think in a different way. And so when I read Scripture, what I'm trying to teach myself to do, because I'm offended in the same way that you are when you read certain things, when I go to Scripture and I find something in a passage that I'm reading that just makes no sense to me, that I don't want to buy into, that's the thing I pay attention to. That's the thing that I say, okay, God, what are you teaching me in this? Where is my idea of you different than your character as you're presenting yourself, as you're revealing yourself? And that's the fortitude that I feel like transcends this idea of radical doubt that really doesn't do us any good. The problem with this radical doubt, even though it's more scientifically minded and all these other things, the problem with this radical doubt is that it's a bias in and of itself. See, Descartes was thinking that if we just doubt everything, it'll remove all the bias, but he just, what, I don't know, maybe he's not as smart as everybody say was, but he didn't realize that doubt is itself a bias. So yeah, you bias yourself to doubt, then you don't have to worry about being influenced by the things you believe, but you therefore truncate your belief. You take your belief and your understanding of God, and you make it no bigger than the size of your skull. And if your God is no bigger than the size of your skull, what good is that God to you anyway? So we're challenged to think in this different way. This way of thinking is doubt first and ask questions later. But this doubt can't cleanse us from bias. It can't get us to absolute truth because there's things that transcend and there's things that are bigger than our ability to prove scientifically. So what happens is you end up with a God that doesn't interfere with the world at all. You end up with a God that doesn't intervene miraculously. You end up with a God that doesn't guide things, that doesn't work in creation. You end up with a God that doesn't come in his son, Jesus Christ, and doesn't die on a cross for us. So the gospel really is not much use to us in that place, is it? It kind of ruins the fun of God coming in a human being, doesn't it? It kind of ruins the Bible, and it ruins the reading today, as Jesus stands before the chief priest. And the chief priest asks him, "Are you the blessed one?" And he says, "I am." None of this makes any sense. The death of Jesus Christ on the cross doesn't make any sense without the resurrection. That's exactly what Paul says, in no uncertain terms, as clearly as he can. He says, if Christ was not raised from the dead, then we among all people are to be pitied most of all. And not only that, you're still in your sin. That what you really need is something that you don't have. We have to ask, what is faith then? If faith is something that we can hold on to, if it's something that we can reconcile with the way that we see the world. I love the way the scripture talks about it. It says, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, and faith is the evidence of things that we have yet to see. See, we think of faith as this leap into the unknown, like it's some sort of superstition that is akin to astrology or just believing that God is dictating everything so that you don't have to think about the world. But instead, faith is the evidence of what we hope for and what we dream for. It's the evidence of God at work in this world. And a few years ago, I went to my brother-in-law's New Year's Eve party, and the only people we knew there was him and his family, and so nobody knew that I was a pastor, which is always kind of funny when you're at a party and people think hear halfway through that you're a pastor, and they go, "Oh, okay." So I met this man that was his neighbor who happened to be an atheist, and sometimes it can get kind of awkward, especially when somebody's had a few drinks. But he hears that I'm a pastor, and from across the room, you see he puffs up his chest, and he comes walking over, and he goes, "Well, I'm an atheist." And so I'm like, okay, here we go. And being a pastor sometimes feels like you have this sign on your head that says, "Please tell me your opinions about all the things that you believe, because for some reason I get to be the target of whatever you feel like you should say." Which is fine. I don't want you to hear that I'm complaining about that, because it's really entertaining, first off, but it also opens a lot of doors to have really great conversations with people. And that's what happened with this man. He comes up, "So I'm an atheist. Congratulations." I'm assuming you want to talk about that now since you brought it up. I didn't ask. We talked about, what he said is that, "Well, you're a person of faith, but I am a person of reason." And besides that being very condescending, I said, "Well, I just don't think that I agree, because I think you're absolutely a person of faith." "No, I don't think that's true." "Well, I really do, because the difference between you and I isn't the fact that I live by faith and you don't. The difference is that what I put my faith in is different than what you put your faith in." "No, I'm not so sure." "Well, let's talk about it. Let's think about it. So you have little kids. You talked about your kids earlier, and you obviously have a car. So you strap your kids into a car seat in that car, and you're putting faith in the people that made that car seat." "Well, yeah, I guess so, if you want to put it that way." And I said, "Well, what about your relationship with your wife? Don't you see that you have a lot of faith when she says she loves you and you believe her?" "But I don't have to take that on faith. I have evidence that she believes me. She does my laundry and takes care of my kids and whatever else, this particular wife did for this guy." And I said, but how do you know she's not just doing those things because it's a mutually beneficial relationship and she's getting something out of it too? How do you know she actually loves you? Because that happens too. And at that point, the conversation kind of went somewhere else or whatever. I think that we need to think about that. Faith isn't this leap into superstition. Faith is the basis of relationship. It's trust. You have faith wherever there's a relationship. Anytime you have a relationship, that relationship is built on faith. Faith and faithfulness go together. So your faith in the other person is based on their faithfulness, and their faith in you is based on your faithfulness. So we see this in our relationship with God. So the divinity of Christ, the ways that we understand Jesus Christ, is like the love between a husband and a wife who are faithful to each other. Except we're not always faithful to God. But the divinity of Christ teaches us that God is faithful to us. You see why this is so important. God is faithful to us, and he sent his son to teach us that. And the fact that this story comes in this dark time in Jesus' life is so powerful and so important, because it's this moment where Jesus seems the weakest, this moment where Jesus has nothing to stand on, where Jesus has absolutely no power whatsoever. He's literally bound, and he's literally being beaten, and he's on trial, and he's standing, and he's being asked to give evidence. He's been asked to give proof so that they can, in the same way that these radical doubters say, prove that he's innocent or prove that he's guilty. But instead of this, Jesus responds in faithfulness to God, faithfulness to God, who's putting him in this place for a purpose. Jesus' divinity comes to us in the exact moment when he seems least powerful, when he seems least divine, and he speaks to us and he says, I am. He says, I am God. He says, you will see me coming in power on the clouds at the right hand of God. And there's nothing that he could have said that would have been more offensive to these radical doubters who are putting him on trial. Nothing. But in this, it teaches us the love of God, and it teaches us that we can't read the Bible the way that radical doubt teaches us to, that we can just pick it apart and read it like we're dissecting a frog in biology class, where you have the spleen over here, and you have the lungs over here, and you have everything all splayed out, and the beauty of it is just gone. We can't read the Bible that way, and I'm not saying that you can't learn something by reading the Bible that way, but it's just short-sighted, and it's insufficient in itself. And I was writing this sermon, I was thinking, you know who can really teach us how to read the Bible? Teenagers in Love. Teenagers in Love can teach us how to read the Bible. And I was thinking back to the times as a teenager when I would receive a love letter. And then I thought, this illustration is totally going to date me because no, teenagers don't write love letters anymore, and this is totally obsolete. But go with me here. I'm going to be the old curmudgeon and say, back in my day, we used to write love letters. But think about a love letter. It comes in the mail, and you open it, and it comes as this thing that your beloved held in his or her hand. It comes as this physical thing. It has the oil of that person's skin on it, and the little curves and the nuances of the penmanship show you the nuances of that person's personality. And you cherish it, and you pour over it, not to pick it apart, but to really look into it and really analyze every word in a loving way, to really see what that person is about. And see the ways that they love you. And it warms your heart. And the letter smells like that person. and so you don't just read it, you breathe it in. Teenagers in Love teach us how to read Scripture. That's how we're supposed to read the Bible. What we need is not more doubt. What we need is not more analysis. What we need is more of the presence of God in our lives. We need to soak Jesus up in that way. We need to be aware of his divinity, not in this abstract sense, but aware of his divinity in the sense that Jesus is alive in this world, and Jesus is with us, and Jesus is for us. And Jesus is the proof that God is with us in the times that are darkest, because we see this story where things could not get any darker, and Jesus is divine in that moment. And Jesus couldn't be any weaker, and Jesus is divine in that moment. And this moment teaches us that when things are dark for us and when we're weak, Jesus is divine in that moment too. God is not distant. God is not slack concerning his promises. The God who spoke heaven and earth into being is also the God that comes to your defense. This is the God that is your shield, that is your defender. He does not slumber and he does not sleep. He will be faithful to his promises. He cannot deny who he is. He is long-suffering. He is not unfaithful to his promises. But he suffers long, hoping that all would come to believe and to be saved. He hopes for you. He has dreams for you. God is not distant, but near to the brokenhearted. The divinity of Jesus teaches us that. It proves beyond any doubt, any radical doubt, that God will not sit idly by while his children suffer. It is proof of God's faithfulness that we can take up in faith. It's the very thing that our hearts long for. That story of Mary in her early 40s is this story of longing. This woman who's completely upside down in her sense of self and completely lost because she's never had modeled for her what it means to be a human being. And she's completely captivated and bound up by addiction and the pain of her past. Chronic alcoholic and chronic agnostic. Her soul is starving and she can't begin to understand why, but she knows it isn't working. She tells a story about grabbing at anything. And so she gets an AA and it's kind of working, but she's not buying into this whole higher power thing. And she admits that her life's out of control, but she's trying with everything she has to stay sober and it just isn't working. She doesn't have the strength. She's working the steps, but without understanding and submitting to her higher power, just isn't working. And she wouldn't give in because of that doubt, because of that intellect, because that radical doubt and how smart she is won't let her let go. She comes to the end of herself. She steps out of this place of radical doubt. She's not at a place of faith yet, but she has this openness about her. She's looking for what there is to worship. And I think it's right on the way that she talks about doubt is this defense mechanism, is this thing that keeps us safe from relationship. It keeps us safe from being vulnerable with people. And at the same time, as she's wrestling with these things, her seven-year-old son, her son that is the same age that she was when her mom had the breakdown and burned all of her things, her seven-year-old son comes to her one day and says, "Why don't we go to church? Let's go to church sometime." And she looks at him and she's like, "Why would you want to do that?" And he said, "I want to see if God is there." And so they went. And she kind of sat there and, you know, was doing the thing for her son. And they get in the car and start to head home. And she goes, "So was God there?" And he goes, "Yeah, where were you?" And at that point, she would take him out, kind of like a parent takes the kids to soccer practice and then sits there and reads the paper or checks email. And she would literally sit in the back of the church and read the paper. And she would take him to different houses of worship from different faiths, and you know, just kind of see, you know, kind of get the smorgasbord kind of, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that kind of approach to religion. And then one day, she takes him to this Catholic church, and none of the things really touched her and really connected with her. And then she's at this Catholic church, and there's this time in the service, this is a small parish, where the priest invited people to stand up and share their petitions for prayer, to share the things that they were asking for prayer for. And somebody stands up and said, "My son just got back safe from Afghanistan, and I'm so thankful." And somebody else stands up and says, "I just found out that my brother has cancer, and I don't know what to do." And then somebody else stands up and shares something else. And she sees these people as they're sharing the deepest, darkest things that they're afraid of. And they're sharing their biggest hopes and their dreams being fulfilled and the things that really matter. And they're here in this public place and they're opening themselves up. And they're coming to this place because they see that what they need is outside of themselves. And they're coming to this place and they're being fulfilled. And they're finding peace. And they're finding comfort. And they're finding all these things that she's lacking in her life. And she sees that and she goes, "This is what I need. This is where I need to be." She's confronted with the divinity of Jesus in the lives of these people who have found Jesus. And it undoes her. She comes to the end of herself. She gets mugged by Jesus. We talk about that sometimes, where we have no intention of it happening the way that it does. But God has different plans. And all we can do is submit to it. All we can do is give in. And she gives in. And it doesn't mean she goes quietly. She's constantly fighting against it. And that's the way we all are, isn't it? But as we think about the divinity of Jesus, it's like that. Even when we are faithless, he is faithful. And he will never deny who he is. This high priest, who's meant to be the embodiment of faith, is meant to be the symbol in the people of what it means to believe in God. He stands in the very presence of God. And instead of being the symbol of faith, he is the embodiment of radical doubt. He stands and says, "Give me the evidence. Tell me why you say you are who you are. Tell me what you're saying about yourself. Defend yourself against these charges that people are making." He stands as the embodiment of doubt. When he's standing in the presence of the incarnation of God, the presence of God in this world is standing right in front of him. And all he has for it is doubt. He tells him, "Prophesy. Prophesy that we will be able to see that you really are the Messiah." His voice is dripping with sarcasm. And he doesn't have eyes to see at that very moment when he's saying that the prophecy Jesus had made just hours earlier is being fulfilled in Peter, who's denying him. Do you see that? When he's saying, "Prophesy," Peter is out there, and the prophecy that Jesus had made is being fulfilled in that exact same moment. While proof is everywhere to be found, for those who are captive to doubt, those of us who demand proof, we miss that it's about relationship. We miss that it's about God coming into our lives. We miss because we demand proof, and it's met with silence. Confronted with this demand for proof, Jesus says nothing. And then the priest erupts. "Are you the Messiah or not? Are you the blessed one of God or not?" And Jesus says, "I am. I am.